Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, yeah, it is so time. It is so time, friends. It is time to awaken America. It is time to awaken to truth. Our very virtues are at stake. This is a very special, special edition of Awaken America, Awaken to Empowerment Radio. This is going to be a deep dive because here's the deal. I'm going in and I'm doing something here with COVID Revealed, Dr. Patrick Gentempo. We promoted it, and it was a free webinar about what's really going on with COVID. And friends, it's stunning, it's frightening, it's amazing, and I hope that the sound comes through clearly. It's amazing, and I'm going to read some of the notes. This whole thing, there's more to this, okay? There's a lot more to this. We're losing our country, okay? And we really need to ask the right questions to get a truthful conclusion, okay? Here, according to Dr. Robert Malone, the MRA tech inventor, this is gene therapy. It is applied for the purpose of vaccination to understand the safety technologies such as mRNA vaccines. You would need a decade-long process. Okay, the earliest seminal papers on mRNA technology. This is crazy. You know, why did the CDC change the definition for vaccine? Yes, the CDC actually changed the definition of vaccine to accommodate gene therapy. The CDC changed the definition of vaccine from producing immunity to protection. This lowers the standards. A proof of vaccine as immunity would imply that prevents disease in the vaccine, whereas protection could be extend to anything that lessens the severity of the disease. This is from justice.gov. America, pharmaceutical giant Pfizer Incorporated and its subsidiaries Pharmacia, and Upjohn, hereafter together Pfizer, agreed to pay $2.3 billion, largest health care fraud settlement in the history of the Department of Justice, to resolve criminal and civil liability. Okay? Justice Department about Pfizer, this is from justice.gov. This is not tinfoil hat stuff, friends, okay? Pfizer, they've False Claims Act. The company illegally promoted 4 false drugs. I mean, and caused false claims to be submitted to government health care programs for the uses that were not medically accepted indications and therefore were not covered by those programs. This civil settlement also resolves allegations that Pfizer paid kickbacks to health care providers to induce them to prescribe those drugs as well as other drugs. All 4 of these vaccine, quote, manufacturers fined over $35 billion for these type of allegations. Under the emergency use authorization, they have zero liability. So if you're damaged permanently for your life or you happen to die, well, now they have no liability. Now there's something called the VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, okay? They reported something like 927,000 injuries. All vax combined for the past 30 years, all injuries from vaccines combined for the past 30 years have only been 854,713. Okay? They've outpaced the 30-year. This is statistics. This is facts, friends. This is to give yourself ammunition when people are like, we got to get vaxxed. This is not a vax. Okay? All right. So this is stunning. Pfizer admits bribery in 8 countries and in shedding in 2012. It also was fined $2.3 billion in record fraud settlement in 2009. something for some report here, grant reporting system, grant ID R18HS017045. Fewer than 1% are reported to VAERS. So here's the deal, and this is all stuff you could Google this. VAERS data includes the vaccines have killed at least, there's several people, okay? Okay, actual numbers, absolute risk reduction, AstraZeneca, 1.3. Oh, these are the numbers of actual risk reduction from taking this jab. Catch this. You ready? Buckle up, friends. The actual numbers of risk reduction from AstraZeneca, the Oxford study, was 1.3%. Okay, 1.3%. Moderna, and I'm not a numbers person, but I don't know, you know, if it gave me 80% or 70% risk reduction, I would maybe contemplate. But 1.3, seriously? You freaking kidding me? Moderna, NIH, 1.2%. J&J, also 1.2%. Pfizer and biotech, this one, the Pfizer, 0.84%, not even 1%. See, the key point about the vax, here's a key point about from the Lancet article, these considerations of efficacy and effectiveness are based on studies measuring prevention of mild to moderate COVID infections, and they were not designed to conclude prevention or hospitalization, severe disease death, or prevention of infection and transmission potential. Okay, so it's just like, okay, you know what, let's just, you know, it's a moneymaker, friends. It's all about the Benjamins. I think Jihad Omar said that. Well, you know what, Jihad, your little buddies, your butt buddies in the pharmaceutical industry and big government, wait till you hear the rest. Key point from the Lancet about transmission of vax. Community transmission and viral load kinetics of SARS-CoV-2 Delta B 0.1617.2 variant in vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals in the UK, a prescriptive longitudinal cohort study, end quote. Fully vaccinated individuals with breakthrough infections have peak viral load similar to unvaccinated cases and can effectively transmit infection in household settings, including fully vaccinated contacts. Okay, now here's a major point. Enhanced pulmonary infiltration of inflammatory microphages and reduced and more severe lung injury compared to unvaccinated animals. By tracking the evolutionary trajectories of vax-resistant mutations in more than 2.2 million carved SARS-CoV-2 genomes, reveal the occurrence and frequency of vax-resistant mutations correlate strongly with vaccinated rates in Europe and in America. Vaccines are causing mutations. It's another major point. New variants, Delta and Omicron, have the mutations in the receptor binding domain, that's called RBD, which make existing spike-only vaccines obsolete. Once Omicron dominates, other evolutionary arms race will take place as long as we are targeting only the spike protein. I got so much here. And don't be a mask cult. Masks are very bad for you. I just have one thing, too, that I really, and I'm going to talk about this again. Here, Harry Truman, show me a man that gets rich by being a politician, and I'll show you a crook. Let's go, Brandon. What happened? What happened, you know, informed consent. Okay, so here, this is the mind to explode. Okie dokie, here we go. This is something called Event 201. Google it, Event 201. Okay, and then I'm going to let the professionals take over and do their talking here, and hopefully it comes through clearly for you because this is going to be a long show. Ready for mind to explode. Here we go. Governments and the private sector, this is something called Event 201. And what Event 201 is, okay, let's talk about it. It was a pandemic preparedness exercise. It was held on October 18th, 2019 in New York City. October 18th of 2019. What happened 2019, 2020? Oh, it was a year before the pandemic actually came out. Ready, buckle up. It was sponsored by Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security in partnership with the World Economic Forum and the, sit down, yes, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Good old Kill Bates. Yep, there he is. Event 201 centers around the fictional pandemic of SARS, which starts in a pig farm. a fictional pandemic, friends. It starts in a pig farm in Brazil, and it spreads to major cities and throughout the world. Imagine that. Then 201, along with previous such simulations, is the playbook for the current COVID-19 pandemic, and many of the steps that were taken with COVID-19 were pre-planned as part of this simulation. All right, here we go, mind explosion. Here's what they said. Governments, this is what they recommend. Governments and private sectors should assign a greater priority to developing methods to combat mis- and disinformation prior to the next pandemic response. Government will need to partner with traditional and social media companies, research and development, nimble approaches to combating misinformation. See, focus on control, press, censorship, and cancel culture. See, what happened to true informed consent? What happened to our medical ethics? Our medical ethics are actually predicated on true informed consent, the full scope of risks and benefits. Come on, it's time to awaken, America. It is time. Now, here, this is something. New evidence, including sworn affidavits from leading experts such as Nobel laureate Dr. Professor Luc Montagnier, have been submitted to the International Criminal Court by lawyers in several countries alleging that governments across the world and their advisors are complicit in genocide, crimes against humanity, and breaches in the Nuremberg Code. Awaken, world. It is time to awaken. Empower yourself with this information. I'm hoping that this is going to go through for you. This is Dr. Patrick Gentempo interviewing folks. I'm going to step away and let this microphone play out. I'm praying that you could get this information because it's so valuable. Here you go. And I'm not going to be on for quite a while. I'm just going to let this play. Ciao.
Our next guest, Dr. David Martin, is literally one of the most fascinating people I have ever met in my
Well, that didn't work so well. Hang on a minute. I'll get back to it. Son of a gun. Hang on.
Are also showing unbelievable.
Hang on.
There's a supposedly front and center.
Hang on.
But I never saw the relevance between the type of work he did, which we'll talk about in a moment, and this whole COVID scenario. So anyway, he's a man that connects dots like nobody else. He's brilliant, but he also knows how to speak in a way that you and I can understand. So let me bring in Dr. David Martin. David, thank you so much for taking the time with us here today.
It is an honor to be here, Patrick, and it's a delight, and well done to you and the entire Jeff Hayes team. The series is brilliant.
Thank you so much, and it's brilliant in large part because you were in it. That's just... remind people before we start taking some questions real quick, the work you were doing and what led you to actually explore this whole COVID scenario.
Well, in many respects, in the effort to underwrite intangible assets for the global banking system back in the late 1990s, I built the systems that used linguistic genomics to identify whether people had legal right and title to the things that were claiming to be the innovation that they were using to run their businesses, to build businesses, et cetera. And quite by accident, we were becoming aware of an enormous number of patents being filed that appeared to be violations of biological and chemical weapons treaties. And it was almost a surprise to see how audacious and in public these statements of, you know, clear violations of the law, where, for example, when the U.S. Army patents a pathogen that can be delivered in a rocket-propelled grenade, you know, that doesn't feel like public health. It doesn't feel like a syringe in a doctor's office. The last time I went to a doctor's office with a rocket-propelled grenade as the delivery agent, I probably left that doctor's office. You just don't do that.
Right.
And when you see patents that include that kind of language, you realize that the illusion that we have of a moral compass that says that the weaponization of the biosphere is something that we should learn our lessons from, you know, the Second World War and some of the things that were done during the Cold War, you would think that somewhere along the line humans would evolve to a point where they realize that biological and chemical weapons are just horrific, horrific experiences in a phase of humanity that we should be past. And you see that it's not only being done, but you see that funding is increasing, that's what set off the alarm bells in 1999, and that's the reason why coronavirus was front and center in our attention from 99 through 2002, prior to the outbreak of SARS, because we saw work being done to make what used to be an animal gastroenteritis disease a human pathogen of consequence, and that's what got our attention.
Wow. So what are the, leading into where we are today with this, what are some of the things that that you have found that that were disturbing from, you know, from the patent standpoint, saying this seems premeditated as compared to it's kind of like this thing that happened, you know, randomly?
Well, I think it's important to realize, and I just made a presentation in Dallas yesterday on this, it's important to realize that when the NIAID, under the leadership of Anthony Fauci, decided to try to find a way to use a biologic model to potentially open up a door for an AIDS vaccine, which is what he was trying to do when he was trying to weaponize coronavirus back in late 90s and early 2000s. What was being done there was actually quite odd. In fact, very specifically, using the language from the patent, which got our attention, was language that said that we were going to make an infectious but replication-defective viral recombinant model. And let's unpack those language for everybody to make sure they understand. What we're trying to do is make a pathogen more harmful to the individual exposed to it, but we're also going to try to make sure that the damage is done to the individual who receives it and doesn't spread. So that's actually quite literally a definition of an assault and battery. That's a weapon where you're trying to harm the person, but trying to diminish the replication or the transmission effect. So an infectious replication defective coronavirus was Anthony Fauci's brilliant idea to build a vaccine vector platform in his long march to try to get the world addicted to vaccines.
Wow. Startling. And I guess there's a supposedly treaties that we're saying we're not supposed to be developing such things, we shouldn't be doing. I mean, is it, I guess there's an argument made with gain of function, you know, that we're trying to stay a step ahead of the vaccines from a public health standpoint, but does this look more like bioweapon to you than it does, you know, public health research?
Well, it's clearly not public health research. Remember that for the decade of the, well, beginning in the late 80s and going through the decade of the 90s, many people were killed in Anthony Fauci's attempts to try to figure out how to either treat or vaccine against HIV. This is an individual who has decided that human life is expendable in the name of not science, but in the name of his technology hegemonic view that the world should become dependent on a universal vaccine platform, which is language he's used actually throughout his entire career at NIAID, but has amplified over the last decade. But if you go back and look at the question of legality, 18 U.S. Code Section 175 makes it illegal to enable the development of, amplify, or produce a biologic agent known to harm humanity and do so potentially either domestically or in collaboration with a foreign partner. And we see that throughout the period from 2012 up until 2016, during our gain-of-function moratorium here in the United States, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and a number of institutions in China, including the Wuhan Institute of Virology, were exchanging information in violation of 18 U.S. Code 175. They were exchanging information to enable the production not only of a worse form of coronavirus, and specifically a worse form of SARS coronavirus, but worse than that, by 2016, they published a paper where they said coronavirus was poised for human emergence. And it's the footnote of that paper that's most problematic, as I mentioned in our interview, which is the Institutional Review Board, which reviewed that study protocol, actually ultimately approved it, but the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, impaneled a second Institutional Review Board to review the legality of the research itself because of the moratorium. And that's funny because in October of 2014, the head of research and sponsor programs at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, had in fact received a letter from NIAID stating that the research that they were doing was in fact gain of function. It says it right in the letter, and it actually says that it's the gain of function subject to the moratorium. But notably, on the last paragraph of the cover page of that October 2014 letter to UNC Chapel Hill, quite ironically, it says, but since we're funding your project, even those of moratorium, keep doing the thing you're doing. In other words, it's a moratorium that didn't have any moratorium at all.
Wow. So in my last segment with Dr. Brian Hooker, a question came in, and we're going to take questions from the audience here in a few moments.
Oh, beautiful.
But a question came in that's really, I think, a question I'd like to pose to you, and you know, my answer was, in short, I don't know. But
wait for Dave.
Let's wait for Dave, because this, I think this is something that you might have some context on, because it's speculative. But the question was, okay, given all that's going on right now, and I gave a full presentation for a while on just an overview on COVID. What is the end game? What do you think the end game of these perpetrators, if you will, is? And I said, I don't know. I'm observing who the culprits are and how they're interfacing with each other between the Silicon Valley big tech platforms, mass media, our government and our government agencies, and the pharmaceutical companies, and how they're conspiring basically in a fascist way. But I don't know where they're trying to go. But if anybody knows or has at least an idea, I think that might be you. Do you have any speculation around this?
Well, so there's a couple macro threads that I think are worth putting at least into the warp of the tapestry of the answer. And I think it is a tapestry. There's a lot of knots in this one. But I think if we look at the warp threads, we've got a very fundamental problem. And the reason why I'm linking this, just to make it abundantly clear, is I'm linking it because it was entirely capricious to say that our target for the deployment of what was called the vaccine program, which obviously in my view is a bioweapons program, but the advocacy was to inject people 65 years of age and older with absolutely no criteria for that. Because remember, COVID-19 is not a disease. COVID-19 is a set of symptoms, and those symptoms have been around associated with many diseases for a very long time. So COVID-19 is just an assembly of already well-established maladies that hit the human race. And it's just now this basket of things that we actually throw into this basket we call COVID-19, none of which is actually overly original. But if we go back and we look at the over 65 crowd, and then we put another piece of data out there, which is based on every single actuarial analysis, meaning the calculations of how long-term asset management performance is going to go, we do know that between 2028 and 2030, according to the official record, the Social Security Trust Fund is going to go to zero. And if we think about what that means, and then we think about the broader implications of that, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid currently cost the United States economy roughly 30% of the direct and indirect consequence of our GDP. What that means is that if we have a bunch of people around who are trying to collect benefits in 2028 and 2029, we actually have a requirement, according to the Social Security's own data, that we needed to decrease benefits by 2011 by 15% and increase the Social Security tax by almost the same. And that's so that we don't run out. Now we're in a situation where to even survive to 2030, what needed to be done in 2021 is we needed to reduce Social Security benefits by about 20%. Now that would mean taking the amount of cash that many people, in fact close to 80 million Americans count on this, it would be taking that cash and reducing it by 20%. That means an enormous part of the country would have a massive erosion of consumer spending and consumer spending power. Rather than doing that, by the way, the Biden administration increased the benefit. In other words, accelerated that closure of the time window. But think carefully about what this does. If we have people routinely exposed to immunocompromised activities by taking more and more and more of these engineered pathogens, and we're calling them vaccines so that people are coerced into taking them, but it turns out that we're going to kill a number of people between now and 2027 and 2028, and it's very easy to see this as a selective and rather macabre way of dealing with the fact that the U.S. government has been illiquid in the Social Security program for many years because of its mismanagement, and now facing an existential crisis, which every single person knows if they read the official statements of Social Security, we know that by 2028, the program's defunct. And the fewer people we have collecting Social Security at the time it goes defunct, the better. So my guess is that at least at a subconscious level, we were more than happy to see our senior citizens incapacitated and potentially killed off so that our liability in 2028 shrinks.
Wow. That's an assertion I haven't heard before. I don't know how to think in those types of terms as far as from, you know, that anybody could be that evil.
But remember, Patrick, you know, you and I have an unfortunate attribute that we share, and that is a moral compass. Remember that Anthony Fauci has made it abundantly clear throughout the entirety of his tenure that human life is expendable in the interest of the advancement of an agenda. I mean, just think about what I just said.
I am thinking about it.
So when he did what he called the three-continent HIV vaccine study and reported that close to 30,000 people were treated in the study and, quote, the study didn't work. That's all he said. It didn't work. Ask yourself the question, if an HIV vaccine study on three continents involving close to 30,000 people didn't work, if you actually think about what's not being said, it's actually horrific. That means people were potentially exposed to a pathogen, people died from the intervention. There is no piece of evidence that tells us anything other than the thing that they tried to do using the HIV model didn't work. And if didn't work is used around the term HIV or vaccine or anything else, unfortunately what you know is that there was an acceptable death rate inside the minds of NIAID that said we're willing to let people die in the advancement not of science, not of public health, but the advancement of a technology hegemony that we've decided needs to land in this universal vaccine mandate. And if you go back to 2011, by the way, this is not an accusation. They actually wrote it into a paper in the World Health Organization in 2011, which said by 2020, the decade from 2011 to 2020 was the decade in which NIAID and its international partners would force the world to accept the absolute hegemony of a universal vaccine platform. So that's not an accusation. It's reading their own documents.
I mean, a lot of this stuff is hiding in plain sight.
Yep.
If you know how to comb through the data like you do.
That's a blessing and a curse, isn't it?
Yeah. Indeed it is. But it's a blessing to us, maybe a curse for you. So let's see questions. Justin, you got some questions for us?
I do, actually. And this is one that's been popping up quite a bit in the media and amongst our following is, first off, they thank us for all of our hard work. We wouldn't be here without them, so it's all good. The question is, with COVID vaccine passports and mandates creeping closer and closer to us, what do we do at that final point when we have been descended, resisted, and stayed awake? When is the absolute, when the stuff hits the fan, what do I do for myself and my young family?
You know, and David, I'm going to toss this. You can't hear, so I have to repeat the question. Basically.
Make it short, that's right.
The question is paraphrasing it basically is this, is that, you know, when COVID mandates, you know, escalate and start hitting the fan and you can't travel, you can't go to restaurants, maybe they won't let you in a grocery store, whatever, what do you do, basically? And a theme leading up to now, and my theme has been, you know, resist, resist, resist. We have to resist this, and the resistance is strong enough. You know, there's, in my mind, you know, if, like, I think they're really hesitant to pull a trigger, for example, on, you know, saying that flights, you know, you can get on an airplane, you have to, you know, you have to be vaccinated. And I think in part because of the economic impact that would have.
Yeah.
You know, they are seeing that there is a significant amount of resistance and that people who are resisting, that what, you know, the consequences that it's having adverse economic impact on varying industries. The restaurant industry is seeing it, you know, for example, when they're trying. So what advice might you have about, you know, what do I do, you know, the questioner said, for myself and my young family, you know, as this escalates? And I'll just say one thing. That is the leverage that they're trying to use to get you vaccinated. They're using varying forms of leverage, and they want to try to make your life unlivable if you don't get vaccinated. And your duty, as far as I'm concerned, is to figure out ways to live without having to succumb. So what are your thoughts, David?
Well, so let's start with, they're not using leverage, they're using coercion, and we need to use the right word because it's illegal. Mm-hmm. Under 21 Code of Federal Regulations, Section 50.23 and 24, it is illegal to make anybody participate in an experimental program using coercion. That is, in fact, how in U.S. law, we actually embrace in U.S. law the Nuremberg Code. So coercion is illegal, and we need to call it coercion. We don't want to call it leverage. We don't want to call it pressure. We want to call it the illegal act that it is. It's coercion. And that becomes important because under 18 U.S. Code, Section 2331, and then subsection 802, inside of the definition of domestic terrorism is any time a U.S. citizen or a government in the U.S. is forced to do something that it would not otherwise do, that's also not only coercion, but domestic terrorism. Now, this conversation and every other conversation, I encourage people to, in fact, take those two laws, and when they are met with somebody telling them they're supposed to get the shot, actually ask the person and record this. Use your phone, use a recording device, record the conversation, and ask if they are in fact violating 21 Code of Federal Regulations, Section 50.23 and 24. Are you interested in doing a civil violation of the law? And if they say yes, they're cool with that, then say, are you willing to violate 18 U.S. Code, Section 2331, which says that it is illegal to coerce a population, and that is a felony, and the felony has a 99-year prison term with it.
Wow.
And so here's the problem. We need to arm ourselves as a big community to not only do what we've done, and by the way, kudos to everyone who has done the resistance up until now, but now we have to arm ourselves with the very weapons they're using and throw them back. I always say the metaphor for me is if somebody throws a hand grenade at you, pick it up, pull the pin out, and throw it back. They've given you the hand grenade, use it. What we need to be doing is we need to be informing ourselves, and most recently, Patrick, and this will be a punchline I get to at the end, but I just put all of the felony statutes and all of the felony evidence into a single document that everybody can use, everybody can reference, and just go to your employer, to your local grocery store, to your local theater, to your local school board, whatever it is, just say, hey, which one of these felonies do you want to be implicated in? Because all of them carry 99-year prison terms and up to $100 million fine. So, and that's $100 million fine for an institution. So it's actually a big deterrent. And as we have been manipulated and coerced as a population, we now need to actually take the offensive position and say, stand up, be informed, and provide the 8 felony counts that you can ask any employer, any business, anybody who's trying to push the mandate, which one of these felonies do you want to now be liable for?
That's brilliant. And I like the idea of going on the offense. You know, I mentioned earlier, I think our last line of defense, or one of our last line of defense, are going to be the courts. You know, we got to get away from the executive branch. You know, we're very dysfunctional in our legislative branch. But the courts, you know, shooting down the mandate, you know, the Biden mandates, et cetera, I think they are our last line of defense. I'm always, you see me smile or kind of chuckle as you're quoting line and verse on these statutes. You know, it's like, you know, how you have all this stuff in your brain is amazing to me. Is there a way that people can get access to the documents you described?
Well, there you go. I feel like I just entrapped you because I told you there is a thing. It turns out if you go to either of my websites, fullyliveacademy.com, that's Fully Live Academy, all one word, fullyliveacademy.com, or davidmartin.world. If you go to either of those two and click on the Attorney General link, what you'll get is actually the criminal indictment template, which has all 8 felony counts that are actually listed right there. And you can download those, as I encouraged people to do yesterday. You can print them off. You can send them certified mail to your U.S. attorneys, to attorneys general in your state, to elected officials in your state, to school boards, to anybody who's doing a mandate, and say, you are now on notice of felony violations. And guess what? Like you just said, the courts are, in fact, going to ultimately deal with this issue. And if you have gathered evidence in your own coercion, in your own manipulation of the things that have been foisted upon you, you will actually be part of the class that one day recovers those damages. So I say stand firm, inform yourself, get evidence, and take action.
I love it. And would you recommend, you know, on a local level or with employers or school boards, what have you, David, that that you can collectively bring other people so you show up as a class as compared to an individual?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But the point is, you know, my grandfather said that you never attribute to malevolence what is ignorance. And the cool thing is that's a great, great axiom to live by, because the truth is that a lot of people are doing the wrong thing because they don't know the right thing. Your job as a member of civil society is to first be informed yourself, but then take it upon yourself in a civil society, in a democracy, to make sure arming yourself with information is in fact itself a gift to the community to go and teach others that which you know. And that's why it's important for us to see this as a moment. See, the tide is already turning. We see the OSHA mandate fall apart. We see the CMS mandate fall apart. We see the large employer mandate fall apart. We're seeing these things fall, but now it's time for us to take advantage of the troop in retreat. This is time to pursue, not to stand back.
Brilliant. I agree. Now's the time to really, I think, like anything else, I think timing is important.
Yep.
And our opportunity is now. So,
that's right.
Yeah. Brilliant. Justin, we have another question.
Yeah, we do. So this question is from a viewer that is with us live right now. It is, I am currently in Oregon where our tyrannical government is trying to force a permanent mask mandate. I would like to know my legal rights to not have to adhere to this.
All right. So the question, David, is I'm currently in Oregon where my tyrannical government is trying to enforce a mask mandate. I'd
correct.
Like to know my legal rights to oppose
yep.
this. And incidentally, I addressed the science around the mask earlier in my presentation, but now as we're looking at somebody that says they want to take a stand and they want to not succumb to a mask mandate, what advice do you have?
Yeah, so sharpen your pencil. You're going to get another reference here. Under the Federal Trade Commission Act, which is actually one of the interesting interstate commerce acts in the United States, under the Federal Trade Commission Act, there's a clause that's called the Deceptive Medical Practices Clause. And specifically what that means is that it is actually illegal in every one of the 50 states to promote a product that actually is promoted to diagnose, treat, or cure a disease without at least 2 independent, peer-reviewed clinical trials which have shown the truth of the statement. Now, here's the tiny problem. C.R. McIntyre did the only placebo-controlled and double-blind and all kinds of other things clinical trial on cloth face masks and found that not only do they not work, but wearing a face mask across a 3-year study increased influenza-like illness. That led to the April 2020 publication by the Journal of the American Medical Association, which clearly stated that a healthy population should not wear a mask. Now, in every state, including Oregon, it is illegal for anyone to practice medicine without a license. It's also illegal to violate the Federal Trade Commission Act, and specifically the Deceptive Medical Practices component of that act. Face masks have never been shown in the standards set by the Federal Trade Commission. They have never been shown to have a benefit. In fact, they have in fact been shown to create problems. So any mandate, any recommendation is first and foremost a violation of the Medical Standards Act of every state. Second of all, a violation of the Federal Trade Commission Act, Deceptive Medical Practices section. And third, against medical advice. Now, that's a defined term. It's against medical advice, or what's referred to in legal jargon as AMA. You cannot be a licensed medical professional and give evidence or suggest therapy that has been contraindicated to the thing you're promoting. And so every single person who has ever promoted a face mask intervention has violated the Federal Trade Commission Act. And once again, inform yourself, inform others, and let them decide if they want to commit what in most states are at least civil charges, and in some places these can rise to felony charges.
David, ideas or these assertions that you have are, they're extraordinary in the sense that they do take all this and push it to the courts, right?
That's correct.
And that's where we can get the relief, because there has been, obvious overreach of these bureaucrats to take, and they do this under emergency powers, which gives them certain, flexibility here. But in the case of, defining the emergency, what is there really an emergency, and then to have, these statutes that you can now get into the court system, this literally, if this was done en masse, where enough people were doing this in enough places, could undo the whole thing.
Well, that's the point, and that's why I'm appealing not to, a few elected officials here and there. This is something where an informed electorate has a role to play in the democracy, and that is make sure that no night passes, none, when every elected official that represents you or is in your jurisdiction is allowed to forget that by failing to prosecute these crimes, children are dying every single day at the hands of a bioweapon that does them not only no good, but in fact harms more of them and maims more of them than any pathogen ever could.
Well, poignant and well put, and you're giving me the sort of inspiration around now's our time.
That's exactly right.
And we just need to be armed with the right tools to be able to go and fight our battle. And in other words, you don't want to fight a battle that you don't have the prospects of winning. But with the things that you're sharing here, I believe, and that we can get this into the court systems and we can turn a tide here. So this is very stimulating, very exciting, and I hope you have good security.
well, you know what? I have the best in the world. I work for the human cause, and I have long held, and you know, it's funny, we're having this conversation. My ancestors were executed in Zurich, Switzerland, for being heretics. And I find it fascinating that we were part of the Mennonite tradition, so that's an Anabaptist tradition. It's part of the Reformation in Europe during the 16th and 17th century. I find it fascinating that even my own religious heritage has gone from being able to refuse baptism of infants, which is kind of how they got their name, Anabaptists, So we were willing to go and be burned at the stake or drown in the Leamont River. We were able to do that and stand for what is right in the 16th and 17th century, but mysteriously the exact same, you know, offspring are now the ones rolling up their sleeves saying that, you know, an injection was somehow a gift from God. And I just sit there going, you know, in what planet do you go from heretic to acquiescence? And my point here is that it's time for us to actually realize that what I'm promoting is, in fact, not even heresy. I'm promoting accountability to the statutes that, in fact, we the people have access to.
Beautiful. Let's get another question, shall we? Justin?
Yeah. This next question actually comes from Dr. Martin's interview in the series.
Okay.
And the question comes from about the life insurance companies and how they're not being impacted by the number of deaths from this pandemic. They're asking if there's sources or reference points that we can point to. This person, Linda, is stating that she is unfortunately not able to find any sources to support his information that he provided. But he says, obviously, the truth is being buried, and I have not been able to uncover this. What can you say to that?
Great. So just to repeat the question, David, this comes from a gal named Linda, who saw our interview in the series, and she said that the actuarial work happening with the insurance companies, the life insurance companies, basically revealed that there's no increase in death rate, and that COVID hasn't really impacted it, et cetera. And she was looking for sources that she said maybe they're buried or what have you, where she might be able to kind of access references around that. Can you share some?
Absolutely, and wonderful question. Every one of the public life insurance companies, everybody who's publicly traded, has to file what's called either 10Q or 10K filings. You find these in the SEC. And you can find them many places. All you have to do is type in the name of a publicly traded life insurance company or look at a company like United Healthcare, which is actually both a life company and a industrialized drug dealer. I'm supposed to say it's a health company. But all you have to do is look at their filings and then go into the financial statements. And that's exactly what I did. What I did was I looked at year-on-year comparisons for claims paid, and in insurance companies, you have to look at a couple different places because they also reserve against future losses. And that's kind of a technical accounting gimmick inside of insurance companies, which is, are you setting aside provisions for an expectation of more claims? So those are two different parts of the financial statement you need to look at. But if you look at that, what you'll find is that not only have the actual benefit payments not gone up, you know, we were supposed to see this increase of 10 to 15% of excess deaths. And the fact of the matter is you should have seen that then reflected in claims paid. In fact, that didn't happen. And worse than that, what we'll see is, if you look at those financial statements, what we'll see is that the number of policies where people either bought new policies or expanded the policies they already had actually also went up in a period where there was a bit of question about whether or not, you know, insurance companies might one day actually call this pandemic or epidemic an act of God, which, you know, could potentially nullify their policies in certain instances. So it's a very bizarre period of time when we saw life insurance companies' profits rise, their expenses, and remember, one of their major expenses is the payment of benefits. And we did not see that rise, which should have corresponded with the CDC's fear porn numbers on how many people were dying. And what we now find, if we look at the global mortality data, is that we may have had a year not dissimilar to 2018, during which there was, in fact, globally rather a large influenza death. And it's somewhat ironic that in 2018 we actually didn't see a significant increase in life insurance claims paid, but slightly modified. But in 2020 and going into the quarterly filings of 2021, we just don't find that. So what I would encourage you to do is actually pull the financial statements, the audited financial statements from this past fiscal year, And the year-end, and these are all going to be reported, by the way, for public companies. They'll all be reported somewhere between March and May. And so just go into the K filings, their 10K filings. Those are the annual reports. And that gives you the year-on-year performance and year-on-year numbers, and that's where we get that information.
Yes, that's great. So for Linda, you know, it's sort of you have to do your own research to glean this information.
Well,
out.
I've actually put the research out in some of my videos. So if you go YouTube and David Martin World on YouTube, I've actually done all of the work for you too.
Oh, so. Great. All right, well, there you have it. So, as I say, there needs to be some sort of a investigative, approach towards somebody pulling all this data together. You've done it already, so.
Yeah, it's all done, but if you want to, listen, I mean, hey, Patrick, you know this about me. If somebody double-checks something and finds out that I have misspoken or there was a piece of evidence that conflicts with something I said, I think it's very appropriate to be called out on it. So if somebody wants to do the independent work and ever address any of these points, I'd be honored to have that happen.
Great. Thank you so much. All right, Justin, what else we got?
All right. So this is a question that's actually come up quite a few times, and I think it's an honest question.
Mm-hmm.
Our stance, and Patrick, your stance, is resist, resist, resist.
Mm-hmm.
What if I'll just ask the question. Do you have a protocol I can follow if I need to get vaccinated? Like, what do I take before, during, and after vaccination to help my body control the toxins? And unfortunately, I think there are some people in the world that just don't feel like they have the option to resist,
right.
And so they succumb.
So, this is sad that the question has to be asked, but.
Yeah.
And the question comes from someone who asks, listen, I know that you want us to resist, what if I'm put into a predicament where I simply just can't and I succumb, because of the coercion, that's being put upon me. Are there protocols to mitigate the potential adverse biological damage that this vaccine can do to my body? It's kind of a paraphrase. My quick answer to that is that I think there are some people who have put together some protocols that I don't have off the top of my head as far as, what you can do to try to prep your body, detoxify your body, et cetera, around this. And David, I don't know if you know of any,
Yeah, I mean, I stick to things where I have entire confidence that I've independently verified things, but I also appreciate the emotional and the energetic urgency of addressing this issue because a lot of people have been coerced and now have both symptomologies or, in fact, are really now encountering some really significant secondary issues. What I can tell you is I have had lovely interactions with people like Dr. Zelenko, with Dr. Christian Northrup, with a wonderful homeopathic doctor, Mitchell Fleischer. He's actually a neighbor in Virginia, close to where we live. I do know that there are clinicians who are working very, very closely with people who have had the injection and would like to detoxify from it or would like to deal with some of the adverse events. And what I would really encourage you, I mean, the three names that I gave are three names that as individual clinicians, I have a deep appreciation for their passion for humanity and for what they're doing. And obviously, the world has become increasingly gaining some sense of comfort around also the work of Peter McCullough, Dr. Peter McCullough. I would encourage people who have that issue to both take a look at the individuals I just mentioned. And once again, what they're doing, I don't have the ability to independently confirm, but I do know that my personal experience with these individuals gives me confidence that their commitment to healing and their commitment to health and their commitment to humanity is something that gives me great encouragement. So I would encourage people to look at individuals like that.
Great answer. Thank you. Great resources. I think we got time for maybe one or two more.
We've got 4 minutes left, so I'll try and get one for you. This one is from a nurse practitioner. She says, my question is, I am a nurse practitioner, and I am alarmed that in the U.S., the COVID policies that are being pushed by sociopath techno giants and globalists, I'm aware of the mass formation psychological abuse. And she links some YouTube, so that's why I'm reading down. It says, the fear factor controlling the world and the Milgram's shock experiment showing obedience to the authority. Let's see. Maybe she doesn't have a question in here.
Is it a statement or a question?
So she said her question is, and so I was reading to try and find her question. And
okay.
So let me jump back down into the next one.
Okay.
Let's go ahead and touch on that one, because it's actually a beautiful framework to really address an important point.
Yeah.
We have the capacity to unplug our addiction to fear reflexes. And even those of us who probably are making what we think of as quite good decisions and so forth, often find ourselves still sucked into what I would call the maelstrom of this fear reflex. That includes people who are talking about things like mass formation and psychosis of social norms and so forth. What I would really love to encourage is to take this opportunity to do deep personal reflection on being an exemplar of a life worth living, rather than being reflexive to a model of manipulation and fear that is in fact enslaving the population. I think there's a beautiful opportunity in this moment to set aside our conviction on being right and embrace our opportunity to model a humanity that others aspire to. And I think when we do that, what we do is we probably do the only thing we can do to address this mass psychosis. Because when we start celebrating diversity of opinion, we start celebrating cultural, social, economic, whatever we want. When we start celebrating the diversity, the ability to agree or be in conflict, but do it in a peaceful and respectful way, I think what we do is we bring down the amplitude of the energy of that psychosis. And I've been encouraging people to use this moment to, rather than being right, be exemplars. Show the world how to live at liberty. And the funny thing is, every mask-wearing, injected person is going to go, I'd like to have what she's having.
I love it. Thank you for that statement. Probably a quick one, if there's such a thing. Let's see.
You've already addressed how you've had your take on having COVID. That's the next one. So I think we had people jump in late.
Okay.
But they're asking, Dr. Martin, what's your experience with COVID?
Have you had COVID or no?
Well, so I have a very funny story. That's a very cute question. And the answer is, courtesy of Mitch Fleischer, the man I mentioned before,
yes.
Kim had a very, very nasty...
Your wife.
...upper respiratory... Yeah, my wife, Kim,
yeah.
Who has been really just an amazing, amazing partner through this whole thing. But Kim had a very nasty upper respiratory infection back in 2018. In the spring of 2018, and I took care of her for 6 weeks, and we kind of made our way through it. And we had a little bit of sniffles and colds and stuff, and so I asked Mitch Fleischer if he would take blood from us and send it off to LabCorp to see if we had what are called SARS-CoV-2 antibodies. The comedy is that apparently I have more antibodies than Kim has, so allegedly we both have had SARS exposure. The funny thing is, I think we had it in 2018, which kind of breaks the narrative down a little bit. Mm-hmm. But the good news is we walk around fully immune to the thing that allegedly we're supposed to fear, because both of us have antibodies that went through the roof. So, you know, did I have it? I think I had a cold that lasted for 2 or 3 days. And I do know that I fed Kim a lot of chicken soup and did all that kind of stuff. Somehow or another, I got more antibodies than she got, and I didn't get the symptoms. So I'm sure one day karma will work its way around, and I'll be miserable, and she'll get a benefit. But there you go.
I just know you as an overachiever, no matter what. So
yeah, if I'm going to have an immune response, baby, I want the best one.
You're going to win.
That's exactly right.
I love it. Well, Dr. David Martin, what a joy to have you here. You really bring a context that I don't see anybody else bringing to this whole scenario, and your ability to assemble disparate aspects of information in different categories and bring them together and turn them into something that fit like a puzzle is really uncanny. And all I can say is I'm certainly glad that your activities are directed toward what you're doing today. I think it's making a huge difference in people's lives and a huge difference in the world. And when we unwind this tyranny and all that it represents and we get back to liberty, it's going to be in large part because of the work you're doing. So I thank you.
Patrick, it's such an honor. And thank you, thank Jeff, thank the whole team. For all the amazing work you're doing, and I am deeply, deeply grateful. It's an honor to work with you. It's a pleasure to have the universe conspire to have our lives meet around this point. I think we were both sent here for exactly the work we're doing. So thank you for stepping up to your role, and it's an honor for me to step into mine.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure, and I look forward to further conversations.
Beautiful.
Take care now. And for you, we're going to take a quick break and then bring in our next guest.
Okay, we're not taking a break here at Awaken to Empowerment Radio. Wow. Wow. Now, remember, this is from COVID Revealed. This is from COVID Revealed by Dr. Patrick Gentempo. And, you know, you could buy this series. Go to COVIDRevealed.com, VRevealed.com, and Dr. Patrick Gentempo, you can go to our website, Awaken, thegreatawakening.ning.com, and you could actually see where we promoted this webinar. It was on for 9 days. In fact, several of us have spent several hours doing it. Now we're going to get into the next interview here. Buckle up, and
one that I collaborate with and that helps.
Here's Dr. Patrick Gentempo, COVID Revealed.
Welcome back. Well, it's been quite a journey for the last few hours, and
whoops. Carol made a mistake again. That's all right. We're going to get it back. Here we go. Sorry. And Rocket
Man. The very impact is find the right one for you, make that investment, and know that you have our gratitude.
All right. Here we go. Sorry. Technical difficulties on the COVID Revealed front. VRevealed.com. C19 own. VRevealed.com. Own this program. It's fabulous.
That our next guest is one of my trusted go-to people when I need to get to the truth around an important subject, especially when it has to do with COVID. You heard me reference him many times in my opening presentation because he is someone that I collaborate with and that helps me to assemble the best available information.
This might get cut off a little early, friend.
The most accurate information that we can get. And I got to tell you, he's been a gift to humanity these past couple of years, sorting through the data, sorting through the science, and bringing it into context, interpreting it, and then giving it out to the world. If you should look him up on Substack. He's writing articles and publishing there all the time, and I'm going there and reading them, and I'm getting a lot of great value out of it. And that's Dr. James Lyons Weiler. So, James, thank you so much for being here with us today, and I know you've been real busy with some things going on, but I'm happy that we have a few minutes with you.
Thank you, Patrick. I hope it's all going well for you today, as it usually does.
It's gone extremely well, and I'm very grateful for the thousands of people who have shown up and who care about this information. And I know having you here with us right now, they're going to really get a lot of value out of this. We have how many questions have been submitted?
I have well over 2,000 questions.
So we have over 2,000 questions that were submitted. But fortunately, when you're answering one question, you're probably answering a whole pool of them. And we have more. So I think if we can, just to try to deliver for our audience, we'll jump into the questions. Terrific. So now you might not be able to hear. James, you're looking at me just on a reference monitor, but we have multiple cameras set up. And we have Justin over here, our trusted guy who's assembling all these questions and then delivering them. You might not be able to hear him, so he's going to toss the questions to me. I'll repeat them, and then we'll discuss them. Let's go ahead and
Okay. All right. Well, Patrick, I was saving this question for the end. I've heard, personally, in the media, I've heard that shedding is not possible with this vaccine.
Uh-huh.
But I'm getting a ton of questions from saying, I have a question on the shedding of the spike protein. How do we navigate shed particles from everyone around us? So I'm wondering if you and James can take a few minutes to address shedding.
Great. Yeah, so the question's around vaccine shedding. I don't know. You can't hear him, right? So, but it's around vaccine shedding. And so, number one, if you can explain what shedding is, and number two, should unvaccinated people have a concern that vaccinated people are shedding around them and maybe passing along things they don't want?
Sure. So I'll try to keep my answer short. But shedding is what viruses do. If you're infected with a virus, it sheds out of the cell if it's the type of virus that buds off of the cell. And then it goes through your mucous membranes and out into the environment somewhere, and people pick it up. So the actual viral particle, depending on the species or the strain of the tree of life, what branch of the tree of life the virus is on. When it comes to vaccinated individuals, I suppose the question is specifically about the COVID-19
vaccine. Yeah, COVID vaccine, yeah.
Then here's what we need to do. We need to ask the question, what is the transmissible element? What would be shed? Is it the virus? Is it the viral particle that the person has a co-infection with? Is it the spike protein encapsulated in the microbody that is in the vaccine? And if so, whatever that transmissible element might be, it has to have a replication mechanism. So shedding would require amplification of the actual particle. However, there's been many, many reports of people that have been or unvaccinated that have been around vaccinated people that then get sick and get sick in weird, strange ways. Some people, for instance, have developed shingles. Well, that could be that the person is now, the virus has changed the methylation of our genome and now of a vaccinated person, and that person now then starts replicating the DNA virus that gives people chickenpox and shingles. That's certainly a feasible hypothesis. That doesn't mean I think it's happening, but it certainly is a reasonable hypothesis. In terms of actually shedding the vaccine constituent parts themselves, you have to have a replication, and the virus itself is capable of replicating, but and reproducing proteins that encode itself. We have to be able to get the spike protein into the genome, have that replicated, and then get it back out of the genome and then encapsulate it with something that would be shed. So early on, the vaccine risk aware community and scientists, ethical scientists, were right on top of the problem of asymptomatic transmission, saying asymptomatic transmission can't take place. Well, now we know that these vaccinated people actually can become infected with COVID, and the amount of virus in their mucous membranes in the nose and in the ears, in the throat, I should say, are on par with the people who are unvaccinated. And so it certainly is, I think, a likely explanation for this is that we're seeing people who had mild cases of COVID that are not vaccinated and then they mount an immune response, and then they get near a vaccinated person who's asymptomatic, that then transmits COVID anew, and so you get another dose of infection. And those secondary doses of infection fall right into pattern where you might have strange, very unusual symptoms associated with the fact that you've been exposed to the viral proteins twice. So, right, through pathogenic priming, you may be experiencing a bit more. It's still mild. These things tend to be mild. They feel sick for a while in very strange ways. So I can't rule it out that they're actually transmitting the virus. I can't rule it out that they're a virus that has been silenced by their immune system and by ventilation is now emerging. But in terms of the vaccine itself replicating, I don't know of a mechanism to do that.
In an effort to avoid it, if it's theoretically happening, I guess what they stay away from vaccinated people, which might not be possible because you don't know who's vaccinated in public settings, et cetera. But ultimately, interpreting correctly, saying you don't have a lot of concern about the shedding aspect of this, that it's something that people don't need to walk around and be that concerned about, is your conclusion?
Well, I don't know if it's a matter of not be concerned about it. That's a black and white question. So, listen, what's happening is that in the same way that social media allows people to share information about what's happening to them with vaccines when they get injured, now we have the same exact social media groups, all the platforms, for people to share their real-time, real-world experience with exposures now to the vaccinated. There's probably a benefit to having a secondary infection to people in terms of a boost in immunity. You get an update on the variant that you're likely to be immune to, potentially. This is all speculative, and I don't want to stick my neck out too far. I wouldn't go so far as to say if you're not vaccinated, you shouldn't be around a vaccinated person to avoid it if you've already been exposed and you've already had COVID. I mean, but if you haven't had COVID, then it's quite possible that you might end up with a SARS-CoV-2 infection. And depending on the strain and depending on your age, depending on the other risk factors, it might be a serious problem.
Okay, got it. So I think one thing I want to do right now is just talk about your credentials for a second, because I think I saw, guys, I saw the placard come up underneath Dr. James Lyons-Weiler. And I think one of the things it said was cardiologist, and that's not, he's a lot of things, but not a cardiologist. So I was just watching on the monitor over here. So let's just clarify, you're a PhD, you're a biomedical scientist. Is your expertise in molecular biology, or, how would you describe it?
Well, I would describe myself as an evolutionary biologist who dedicated his life to biomedical research. In 1999, I made a switch from going into evolutionary biology to study evolutionary genomics, to go hardcore full-time into studying cancer biology and understanding the pathophysiology of cancer, the etiology of cancer. And then I moved big time into biomarker research to be able to predict who would be able to come out of cancer treatment safely. So drug safety has been part of my research since 2002 intensively. Early detection of research. I was part of the early detection research network at the NIH, the National Cancer Institute, while I was in the Department of Pathology at the University of Pittsburgh. So yes, I'm not a cardiologist. I don't have any area of specialty. My genetics professor, Dr. Peter Rosenbaum at SUNY Oswego, actually told me you should never, ever specialize. Stay a generalist. And I did. So when I was in all these different graduate programs I was in, I took all kinds of classes. I learned as much genome biology and chromosome biology and molecular biology as I could in preparation of trying to understand evolutionary dynamics of the genome. And then when I transferred over to biomedical research, at the University of Pittsburgh primarily, that all paid off handsomely.
Great. So thank you. I just wanted to make sure that we clarified that. Justin, what's the next question for us?
All right, so the next question is we have a really big following in Australia, and I think we've all kind of seen what's happening down there.
Indeed.
This question is, in our series, we mostly talked about the mRNA vaccine, but there's roughly 6+ protein-based vaccines that are going to be coming out from what I've been reading. are any of them safer than the mRNA vaccine, or are we all going to assume we should resist?
So the question, I think it comes from Australia. We have a large following down there, and certainly we know the kind of stuff that's going on in Australia. And just know that if you're in Australia and you're with us right now, we stand with you. You know, it's horrifying. I just want you to know that there's people here in the United States that are watching what's happening in Australia, and quite frankly, we're horrified. And you have our empathy, you have our support, and we stand with you. The question comes that most of, you know, what's going on right now is it's happening through mRNA, you know, the vaccines that we're resisting. And incidentally, when we're saying resist, it's not just the vaccines. It's resist the tyranny in total, resist the censorship, resist all of it, not just don't get the shot, if that's what you choose. The resistance is beyond that, because the principles of what we're dealing with right now is beyond whether to get a shot or not. It's a much more global civil rights and civil liberties issue. So I just want to clarify. So the question is that, you know, we're resisting getting the mRNA jab at this point, but there are maybe 6 protein-based vaccines or more that are in the pipeline right now that they're looking to bring to market. Should we feel better about those, or feel like that maybe this is going to be a better alternative, or what's your view on that?
Well, I'd say to the audience, raise your hand if you love human beings. If you love people on this planet, then it's your job to make sure that you tell everyone, in public health officials, make sure you tell your doctor, make sure you talk with everyone in the community, that these protein-based vaccines, they may already be in the pipeline, but unless they take the unsafe epitopes out, the unsafe parts of the protein that then cause us to mount an immune reaction against our immune system cells, our immune system proteins, then there's no reason to expect whatsoever that a vaccine is not going to make people sick through pathogenic priming. Okay, so I have never been anti-vaccine. I have been 100% been safe vaccine. If somebody looks at the risks and the benefits, then they make the choice to get a vaccine, they should. What I'm against and what I'm resisting against is the impediment of people being able to make an informed decision, because the obfuscation of reality, the twisting and distortion of the facts so that they don't know what the risks really are. And, you know, how can you assess the benefit of a vaccine or any other medical procedure if you don't know the benefit of the risks? You really have to be able to do that. And so biochemically, I would say, or biologically, it's not too late. We might see a COVID-19 vaccine developed sometime where they actually go and they, like I did, I looked at it, Butch Donnie and his team at Harvard University validated my work, that there are parts of the spike protein, there are parts of the other proteins that can make people sick. The spike protein is not by any means the most dangerous part of the virus. It's just the most active one. It's the interface between, as people know, the receptor, the ACE2 receptor for cell entry and the virus. But there's a larger protein that has more pathogenic priming epitopes in it that are immunogenic. They'll cause an immune reaction, but are also autoimmunogenic, can cause disease. And so what I want to do is I want to shift the entire conversation, vaccine versus natural immunity, even though I've engaged in that conversation. I don't want to think about the risks of the vaccine or the risks of the danger of the virus. I want to think about the risks of the danger of the protein. Once we change the discussion 100%, both sides can talk to each other. That's the conduit where pro-vaccine people and anti-vax people or vaccine risk-aware people can talk to each other about what the safety margin is through exposure. And until we do that, we're just going to see society continuously in different areas of the world grind themselves and destroy themselves and kind of implode. And I agree with you 100% about Australia. In fact, I announced 2 years ago that Australia had fallen. I could see the police state coming. And you're exactly right. The societal machinations, totalitarianism, are well underway. And the people who are in control and doing this, I don't believe they have any clue of the damage that they're doing to civil rights. I believe that they believe with their whole heart they're doing the right thing, because they've either drank their own Kool-Aid or they don't read enough science. They don't know how to understand what studies are saying. And they're a significant problem. There are plenty of people on the other side that know exactly what they're doing. It's hard to tell a lie faithfully and consistently unless you know exactly what you're lying about, like Anthony Fauci, for instance, and others who have misled the public down this path of destruction of entire potential civilizations. It's that bet.
Indeed, it is that bet. Thank you. Justin, what do we have next?
So this is another question from an Australian. It says, as per shedding, what about the vaccine that was designed to shed to depopulate the mouse population in Australia, as was discussed in the interviews? Wouldn't this be the technology needed to shed the actual vaccine instead of just the disease?
So also from Australia, paraphrasing the question, they said, you know, what about the vaccine that was designed to shed that to decrease the mouse populations in Australia, or I don't know if it was Australia, in Australia. You know, is there maybe an agenda here that they've designed this vaccine to shed, you know, so that people who don't want to get it end up getting it anyway?
Well, thank you for asking that question, because the actual hubris of humanity to actually do something like that, to release a virus that can infect mammals into the wild that then would, you know, be designed to be super spread, as if there's no potential whatsoever for an ecological blowback disaster. You know, the marsupials and the monotremes that are in that part of the world, they're not immune to viruses by any means. So from an evolutionary standpoint, a conservation biology standpoint, you know, there's a lot of stupid things that people do in the name of, you know, being able to do the science that they're doing, and you know, releasing other animals into new environments to control pests and, you know, things like that. I have to say yes. I mean, we have the technology to create a sheddable virus, a vaccine. That is, by definition, then becomes a virus. If you inject someone with something that has the capacity to replicate and then shed, it's a man-made virus. It's not a vaccine. And, you know, I've heard many, many references to Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation in terms of, well, we're going to create the mosquitoes that inject us with the vaccines that we all need to stay alive, because we can't possibly live without mosquitoes injecting us. There's a lot of crazy ideas out there. And this is where humanity really has to come up with, we have to grow up. Our civilization, our society has to grow up and realize that we are not yet at the stage where we even understand the nature of the fire that we're playing with. We are just coming out of the cave, and it's just impossible to even catch a breath sometimes when I read the headlines and I see some of the very dangerous things and manipulations. Just because we have technology doesn't mean we have license to use it. We really have to put the brakes on and do a good, long, hard think about exactly what it is that we're doing, the attendant consequences, not just the first effect of something, the second and the third and the fourth indirect effect. People are culpable for those as well.
Yeah, the word that you use that stands out around all this is hubris. And when scientists start to display hubris and arrogance, where they believe they can just bend nature to their own, you know, will, when they have such real limitations in their understanding of what's true, what's real, and how, you know, what the unintended consequences could be from such acts, it's something that's very, I guess I could say, disturbing and threatening. So thank you. Justin, what's the next one?
Awesome. So this one is, they want to say thank you, Patrick, and Revealed Films team, for all the amazing work we've done and for our desire to educate the world. So their question is, this question is from Debbie. She says, my question is, are the unvaccinated at risk if we need blood in the future? Explain blood donor of vaccinated persons given to unvaccinated.
So Debbie's got a really interesting question. She said, do the unvaccinated should they have a concern? Should they need blood donated in the future? In other words, if there's blood taken from a vaccinated person that has to be used for some sort of transfusion to an unvaccinated person, does that sort of give them a proxy vaccinated status?
Well, that's a good question. So the vaccine itself has a decay factor, right? So the doses that I've seen in mouse studies and human studies, it doesn't persist into perpetuity. I think that there should be a moratorium on donating, you know, for 3 months or so, maybe it's 4 months after vaccination. And when people have asked me this question before, Debbie, I have said that check with your doctor first, because I'm not a medical doctor, but you may want to blood bank your own blood, right, and build a blood bank, a trusted keeper of that blood, in case you are in a car accident in your hometown, and they can get that blood to you and help you out. And, you know, the people who are not vaccinated should keep track of each other's blood types, right, and share. So you should know, if you're O positive, you should know four or five people that you can call on for an immediate leader if you run a little low, you know.
Yeah, so and fortunately, I think that's my wife is, so I might have it right in my home. So thanks. Great question from Debbie. Okay, Justin, what's the next one?
All right, so this one is, can we please talk about aggressive cancers in people and how they are being dismissed at hospitals for COVID patients? I don't know if there's anything to be said to that. So it says, please talk about aggressive cancers in people in remission after they've gotten the jab. I have lost several friends lately to sudden resurgence of cancer.
I get it.
Yeah.
Okay, so this question is basically raising the question of that there seems to be a sudden resurgence in aggressive cancers in people who, after they get vaccinated. Is there the potential, theoretically or otherwise, that somebody who is injected with this vaccine or these vaccines, it could create a situation where they suddenly have aggressive cancer formation?
Well, there's a couple of mechanisms why that could absolutely happen, right? So pathogenic priming leading to autoimmunity against proteins throughout the body, this particular virus hits many, 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 many different proteins that way. And so, yes, if you're knocking down a P53 or some tumor suppressor gene that way, it's possible that you might get some de novo tumors. The other way is that you could have autoimmunity against the parts of the immune system that fight off cancer. I think, being a cancer researcher for so many years, we all get cancer all the time. Our immune system quite literally kills the cells because they look strange. Well, if you have autoimmunity to that part of the immune system that recognizes self versus non-self, it is so likely, I think, people that have parathyroid and thymic conditions are known to have an increased risk of cancer because they're not signaling self versus non-self very well. But then there's also the third possibility. You know, there's several studies that show that when you put the mRNA vaccine into human cells, that contrary to the purpose of the vaccine, we actually do see that if there's a retroviral, reverse transcriptase encoded by a retrovirus, or a reverse transcriptase that might be in a dormant virus that's in the genome, it is possible for the mRNA to be rewritten into the human genome. And the problem with that then becomes, well, if you're getting insertional mutagenesis into the human genome of anything, it doesn't have to be, especially because it's the mRNA for the spike, but then you can have double-stranded chromosome breaks and mutations through arbitrary hits. Any source of mutations is a mutagen, and if this vaccine is mutagenic, I am deeply concerned. So how many people have HIV who got vaccinated? If you have HIV and you get at the same time, you get an outbreak in your body of HIV circulating viruses, then it's possible you have random insertional mutagenesis in some of the cells, then it's totally possible that that's a highly plausible possibility. And I would like to do a study, actually, of all health outcomes of people who have been vaccinated versus those who haven't been vaccinated. Now, remember, some of those mechanisms overlap with infection, right, because it's the same proteins. As I said earlier, the risk, right, you're always going to get both sides of the story from me, so that's why, you know, I come across as, I guess, so honest, but it's not that I can't choose. People sometimes say, you have to choose a side here, buddy, but in reality, it's possible that the SARS-CoV-2 virus could also be mutagenic to some extent. The difference is the size of the genome. So I think it would be very difficult to get an entire SARS-CoV-2 genome into the nucleus as opposed to the much shorter spike protein. But it's worth taking a look at, and I'd love to be in a position to do that study. Right now, the only thing stopping us from doing it is funding. So thank you for that question.
Well, let's see if we can't get IPAC some funding to get this study done. It'd be a great one. Thanks. Justin, what have we got?
Yeah, so the next question is actually a question that I had myself, but I'm happy that other people are asking it, is just recently, within this last week, I saw on the news that the FDA is not going to release their findings on the COVID for 75 years. Why is that?
So there's been some headlines around the FDA, James, that they're not going to release their findings around, I think, COVID or the vaccine studies for 75 years. Do you know anything about that, and why would they? It's almost like the Kennedy assassination. You know, it's got to get time capsuled. Why would there be a need to time capsule any of this?
Well, if we go to the Kennedy assassination, my understanding of what happened there was that one of the Secret Service agents accidentally fired off a shot that hit the president, and so, you know, this was something that they couldn't tolerate the public knowing.
I've heard other theories around that, incidentally.
Right.
So there's varying theories around it, but
right.
There's something to hide that would create public, ire of or worse. So in this case, what is it that they're actually not going to release for 75 years?
Right, and so where I was going with that is we can debate Kennedy later. I don't have a favorite theory there, but that's the most recent one that I've heard. I didn't know about that one. Listen, when the government does this kind of thing, the companies ask the government to do this particular case, there is something else going on. There's something going on that they know that there would be political ramifications, personal liability, responsibility, that there would be potentially a massive revolt against the reality of the actual story, and that massive revolt would be damaging to the status quo. So it's an existentialist threat to them, but they want to hide it for 75 years. When I heard that, I was actually surprised that they didn't wait 125 years. You know, why not lock it up for 125 years to make sure there's no living memory of it, right? So we can't have any live interviews later on about people who knew the truth. But listen, this is, I don't think this is going to stand. I don't think that the public is going to have the stomach for this, because what we live in a world right now where we were told that these vaccines were going to actually end the pandemic. It was going to stop transmission. It was going to prevent infection. It was going to reduce hospitalizations and deaths. And what we're seeing now is vaccine failure. Vaccine failure occurs in phases. The first phase is that it doesn't prevent transmission, like pertussis and mumps. And then the second phase that's coming is that you could actually still get the disease. And the third phase is that the vaccinated are likely to see disease enhancement and be worse off than having not been vaccinated. Like we haven't yet seen that with the mumps, but we certainly saw that they had to shut down an entire Navy ship due to the lack of efficacy against the mumps. And so this is pharma's MO. They cover up, they hide, they obfuscate, they, you know, complicate. And I don't think the public is going to have the stomach for this when they, you know, when the news came out from Barnstable County that the vaccinated still had to mask, there was quite a large blowback politically on that. The vaccinated are saying basically, what the hell is going on here? You told us that we could get by, if we vaccinated, we could go back to work, we'd get our lives back, we'd be free, we would take our masks off. And people felt duped. And that's the first stage towards vaccine, what I call vaccine risk awareness, but really, you know, that's one of the red pills that people have to take. And the other red pill that's waiting for them, of course, is that, hey, I'm still getting COVID. I still might be hospitalized. Wait a minute. A loved one died and they were vaccinated. This was supposed to prevent this. And now you're telling me I have to booster time and time again. Then, well, I saw a person that had two boosters. This is what's going to happen. People are going to eyewitness firsthand experience. People that had two boosters and they still died, then they died with more severe COVID, but they were of an age group that didn't used to get severe COVID. Right? And so that's what I think is going to be witnessed, and based on those real-time
Which is the very definition of disease enhancement, right?
That is the very definition. Yeah. My point is that it's not going to take 75 years for that to happen. The public's going to wake up over the next 2 years.
It's a great point. This is actually raised an interesting question that you may or may not know the answer to, is that, you know, they said they want to, you know, not release this information for 75 years, which I don't, it's intolerable. Especially in light of what's going on right now, we want answers. Our friends and loved ones are dying. We want answers now, not 75 years from now. Does the president, do you happen to know if the president, since, you know, he's, it's the executive branch and these are the agencies can say no. You know, we're not giving you the 75 years. We're letting, you know, we're good. So if an, you know, and I would never expect Biden to do that, but if a new administration comes in, they could say, no, we're going to release it now, which would be interesting.
I think that they can influence it. I think that would go to court. They would have to, you know, the company would fight it and things like that. But, you know, I think our best shot at undoing this is a whistleblower. So, you know, there's a lot of initiatives out there. Steve Kirsch, for instance, has put his money where his mouth is, you know, guaranteed huge amounts of money for whistleblowers to come out. If you don't know about that, look it up. Steve Kirsch, he's a serial entrepreneur. I can't speak for him or make a commitment for that today because it's not my money. But he offered Gavin Newsom $1 million and Gavin Newsom's wife $2 million if they came out and told the truth about what happened to Governor Newsom. And I wrote to him and I said, Steve, give the money to me. You'll get a hell of a lot more out of my pack than you would from Gavin Newsom.
Yeah. So if we have a quick one, Justin, otherwise we've got to wrap.
Yeah, not a problem. This one is actually speaking to Canada with the lockdowns. Their question is, this is from Andrea. You may or may not know, trust me, we know, that in Canada, the unvaccinated have the same status as terrorists, basically. I don't know if I'm correct in saying that, but we cannot fly, we cannot take the railway, we cannot take any form of public transport, we cannot go to restaurants, gyms, theaters, and the Ontario government has just announced that the V-passport system is becoming digital. Do I have to apply, do I have to basically succumb to this? Or can, what are the options for Canadians?
So this comes, a question from a friend north of the border in Canada. They said, I don't know if everybody's aware, but in Canada right now, we're basically, if you're not vaccinated, you can't fly, you can't go on the railways, you can't go to the gyms, you can't go to Russia, you can't do anything. Basically, you're shut out of life. They've taken away all your social freedoms, economic freedoms, as well as your medical freedoms or health freedoms. And making it almost impossible to try to function as a citizen and live and survive if you're not vaccinated. And, you know, what are my options here? Do I succumb? And, you know, I'll make a comment or two, and then I'll see, you know, a couple of short comments that you might have because I got to wrap up here in a couple minutes. Number one, you know, what I would say is, and it comes off the heels of what Dr. James Lyons-Weiler just said, is that pretty soon there's going to be more and more damning data coming out about the mass vaccine program. I think it's going to be irrepressible. I think they're not going to be able to hold it up, and they're going to have to reverse course. And I would say resist as much as you possibly can resist and see if there can't be a turning of the tide that I think is coming hopefully in the very near future rather than succumb and say, I'm going to have to just, you know, I can't function anymore. I might as well just get vaccinated. But do you have any further comment on that, James?
The Canadian people are some of the kindest and most loving people I have ever met and known.
True.
Almost to a person. I've never met a Canadian citizen I haven't immediately fallen in love with. Listen, Canada has other laws on the books. You got to ask yourself, this is a legal question, not a medical question. What legal rights do you have as a Canadian citizen that have been infringed upon? And, you know, in the United States, what I'd like to see is someone say to an employer, listen, you're going to force me to be vaccinated or I can't have my job. You just threatened me. You threatened me with coercion, and the coercion is to enroll in an experimental human subject study design. And I am 100% certain that on the books in Canada, in the regulatory science, in the regulatory laws and rules governing human subjects research, that it is probably against the law in Canada to coerce someone into a human subjects research study. These are under emergency use authorization. These are still, Canada's still learning. Canada, the FDA of Canada just announced that men up to the age of 29 should not get the Moderna vaccine anymore because of the threat of myocarditis. So how is that not an experiment? This is a living, live, full population experiment. And to coerce someone is morally wrong, ethically wrong, and I would argue legally wrong. So I would say exhaust all of your legal options first and find your rock star, you know, legal mind, send them to me. I'll be happy to talk to the lawyers and send them and help them make their arguments about the ethics and the morals of biomedical research. This is a very, very, very important battle that we have to win, because if we don't stand up to pharma and prevent them from making the governments, allowing the governments, empowering the governments to force us into their experimental trials, it won't stop with vaccines. Psychotropic meds are coming next because, oh, well, you don't think right, you don't speak right, you don't believe in the right things politically. We're going to target you with drugs and make you change your behavior so you're more acceptable. And so, you know, I want to encourage you to stay in the fight for your rights, not because I'm giving you medical advice about a vaccine. That's your individual personal choice, but so that you can preserve those rights so we don't have a totalitarian drug state that is absolutely underway.
Dr. James Lanzweiler, thank you for your time. Thanks for contributing to COVID Revealed, and thanks for being here today for our live webathon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Well, for you, thank you very much for your time today. We take your time very seriously. We know that you invest your time, and we don't want to waste it. We want to make sure we're constantly delivering value. So we've done 4 hours of content here. It is being recorded, and there will be replays for a limited period of time. So if you've seen things here that you think you want to have other people see, please refer them to sign up for our series. If you go to BeRevealed.com, they can still register, and then they can get access to look at the replay as the replay is happening, because everybody that registered will be sending links so you can watch the replay. If you didn't see parts of this, you'll have the opportunity over a couple of days to be able to take a look at it. If you want to revisit my COVID presentation, which were the biggest takeaways from what I learned through hosting COVID Revealed, you'll have that opportunity too. And we still consider this to be within the free viewing period, which means that if you happen to be somebody who has not invested in COVID Revealed, you can still do that at a significant discount with extraordinary bonuses that we've added to the package that can get into your hands. There is, you know, obviously we're in a circumstance where censorship abounds. We are in a tyrannical state. As I said in my opening statement, our email, you know, has been blocked trying to get emails noticed to people to be able to watch this. Our text messages have been blocked trying to get text notices to people who have been trying to watch this. The best and safest thing you can do is own this information. Have it in your hands, in your home, and that way nobody can take it away from you. I really appreciate the support that we have received. It's been overwhelming, not just from the, you know, in the sense of people who actually purchased the COVID Revealed series, but the support we received and encouragement from people who are cheering us on, because I have to tell you, you're facing the fire when you go public with this kind of information, and we at Revealed Films have been facing that fire, but we're not going to be deterred. We're taking our stand, and we're getting this information to you in any way, shape, or form that we can. So we have great purpose in this. We experience that purpose. Behind the cameras, behind the lights, and all around me are people who were working tirelessly around the clock to circumvent the censorship, you know, find other ways to get our emails delivered, find other ways to get our text delivered, to make sure that we can get this information to you. We have, I think, the most dedicated team out there today in the world who's trying to do this type of work. They're extraordinary individuals. I get to sit here in front of the camera and actually speak to you directly. But trust me, there's a lot of people who are not behind this camera who are very, very committed to this cause. So I want to thank you for being here. I hope you'll get other people to watch this replay. You might want to revisit it yourself. And again, thank you for your time. It's so wonderful here to connect with you. And I look forward to our paths crossing again soon, and that will end this broadcast. Thank you.
Wow.
What do you think? I think it's time we really awaken. I think it's time that we join together and get this thing going and pay attention to what's going on. This webathon has vreveal.com/C19/own. You could support this movement and own this series, and it's totally worth it. So there's a lot more here, but in 8 hours this thing will be over. So thank you for joining me today on Awaken to Empowerment Radio, Awaken America. It is so time. It is so time to for us to awaken. You know what I'll do? I'll play a little bit of Patrick's interview here from the beginning, and I'll just let it sign off with that. So let me find it, and thank you. Lots of really interesting stuff. Let's see. Here we go. I don't know if this is where it's going to start.
They can't deny the fact that the definition
here. Here.
And that's been well documented.
Here. This is some of the stuff we were talking about. Here we go. Let's just start here and enjoy. Have a great one. Talk to you later. Carol Ann Parisi. But listen to this interesting info.
Those terms, but they're going to fall into two broad categories, safe and effective. And that is the mantra we hear in the media over and over again, safe and effective, 95% effective, etc. So that question forces them to divulge what they know about the vaccines or don't know about the vaccines. So once you ask that question, now let's assume that you got something about first safe, okay? So, and we're going to explore how to answer the question. You know, how to answer the issue of are they safe or effective. Now, somebody says to me, well, they're safe. My next question, again, I'm not going to say, no, they're not, don't you know this or that. I'm going to ask another question. My next question is going to be, why do you think these vaccines are safe? See, that's in that second branch of philosophy. I talk about epistemology or rules of evidence. They're going to say something like, well, it's in all the headlines. I mean, where do you think they got this information? They got this information because they hear it on the news headlines, the mainstream media. They're getting it in social media, et cetera. They really haven't, the vast majority of the people really haven't studied this subject. There are some who have, who I've had debate with, some of whom are even, you know, doctors and, you know, have some healthcare background. But still, when I press them on the issue, why do you think they're safe, you know, they'll cite the study, that Pfizer did or something to get these things approved under emergency use authorization. So I'm ready for those types of statements, and then here are some of the responses to the question, why do you think these vaccines are safe? I want to hear what they have to say, and then I can respond. So here are some of the potential responses. We'll get into those right now. According to Dr. Robert Malone, who is the pioneering inventor of mRNA technology, this is gene therapy applied for the purpose of vaccination. That's a direct quote right out of my interview with him in the COVID Revealed series. This is gene therapy technology applied for the purpose of vaccination. Now, he's got the earliest seminal papers on mRNA technology. If anybody's got a right to speak about this, he does. Further, Dr. Malone states that to understand the safety of a technology such as mRNA vaccines, you would need a decade, and I'm quoting right from the interview, a decade-long process. To him, it's 10 years before you understand the safety of what you have. And again, the reference I put here for you is the COVID Revealed interview, December 2021, you know, this month. Why do you think these vaccines are safe? We're still on that question. So this is, you're seeing a headline that I cut and paste here for you. And incidentally, with these, you know, these are like, you can get online, you can search these right away, and you can dig deeper into the articles if you want. I've read them all. Why did the CDC change its definition for vaccine? Agency explains move as skeptics lurk. Now, even the people who are very pro-vaccine and think this is a good thing, they can't deny the fact that the definition got changed. And that's been well documented, and I'm giving you right here, it's cited, you know, in a major national newspaper. Why did the CDC change its definition for vaccine? So what did they change exactly? And a lot of people, you know, we interviewed, if you watch the series or the whole series, you've seen them speak to this, and it's multifaceted. I don't think there's just one reason. I think there's probably a lot of reasons. But the fact is, and it's a fact, they changed the definition. The CDC changed their definition of vaccine to accommodate this quote-unquote gene therapy. Now, I don't want to go too far down rabbit holes of science here, and quite frankly, the science around all this is quite complex. When we're getting into molecular biology and virology and vaccinology, this is not kind of just simple headline science. I mean, there's some deep expertise required to fully understand it. And as I said in my disclaimer, I'm none of those things. I've just been interviewing people and doing my own research to try to get some context for it. Because some experts are saying, well, it's really not technically gene therapy, mRNA technology. It's transfection. But because there can be, I guess what they would refer to as reverse transcriptase, that, that can occur when you're using mRNA technology, it becomes gene therapy. So it gets a little bit nuanced. It gets a little bit deep, and I'm keeping it kind of on a basic and simple level, and I'm also taking it from the experts that we interviewed and communicating it here. So I understand that some people maybe have a little deeper knowledge saying, wait, it's really not gene therapy. It's not, maybe you're saying it's transfection, it wasn't intended to be gene therapy, but it becomes gene therapy when you start to apply it in reality. I'll just say that much on it, and again, Dr. Robert Malone, who is a pioneering inventor of this technology, refers to it as gene therapy. So I'm going to leave it at that. So basically, the CDC changed the definition of vaccine from producing immunity, meaning that in order for something to qualify as a vaccine in their definition, it needs to produce immunity. They downgraded that for this and said it is just needs to afford protection. Very big difference. And you'll see soon why that matters. This lowers the standard of proof for the vaccination, as immunity would imply that it prevents disease in the vaccinated, whereas protection could extend to anything that lessens the severity of the disease. And this is where, I have slides on this later, where they keep moving the goalposts from it starts with, oh, this is going to prevent you from getting COVID, to, well, it doesn't really prevent it, it doesn't really protect you. What it does do is it lessens the severity of disease should you get it, and we get into how this has migrated and changed over time. The CDC, let me advance this slide. Okay, there it is. So, again, we're on the question, if I'm asking you Socratically, why do you think vaccines are safe? I have to tell you, when I've gotten into this next series of slides with people, because the other stuff, they might get a little blurry-eyed, gene therapy, I don't understand the difference, and you have to kind of get into it. This, I think, is maybe some of the most damning reasons why we shouldn't just assume these vaccines are safe. Pfizer. Let me just start this way. Vaccine manufacturers collectively have a sordid history of fraud and corruption and malfeasance and deception and all kinds of really bad things. So I'm giving you just some snippets here to highlight that. In this headline, Pfizer admits bribery in 8 countries. So some highlights from this article. They were fined $60.2 million for bribery. The penalty is roughly, now listen to this, you say, wow, that's a lot of money they were fined for bribery in 8 countries. And again, Pfizer. What do you keep hearing about the Pfizer vaccine? It's probably the one that's in the headlines more than any of the other ones. The penalty is roughly 0.5% of the company's annual profits that exceed $10 billion a year on global sales of $67.4 billion in 2011. So let's talk about this. This, I believe, and I might not be remembering perfectly, but I think it was roughly 2011, 2012, when they were found guilty of bribery in 8 countries and they were levied a $60.2 million fine for bribery. But here is something I really want you to know and understand. This was after, okay, you hearing? This happened after what? A few years after this. Pfizer is fined $2.3 billion in record fraud settlement. So the pharma giant illegally promoted product, Justice Department says. They're fined by the U.S. Justice Department $2.3 billion, and it was a record fraud settlement. Fraud! They're fined for fraud. You know what fraud is, right? It is the largest healthcare fraud settlement in history today. Now, this was in 2009, September 2009. So, mind you, they get fined $2.3 billion for fraud, and a few years later, they're further fined for bribery in eight countries. There's nothing that dissuades these people from committing criminal acts of fraud, bribery, and other such things to get their products distributed. These are the same people who are making these vaccines, making the representations about these vaccines. They stand to make more money from these vaccines than anything else they're doing as far as their business activities, and they have no liability for the vaccine. For these drugs that they committed fraud on, they have to carry their own liability insurance for them. And if somebody gets hurt because of their drugs, they have to defend it. They can be sued. With these vaccines, which are approved under emergency use authorization, that shields them from any liability. If somebody dies, is injured by their vaccines, they have no liability. So how am I supposed to trust them? Are you seeing a pattern of behavior here? I mean, this is not like, oh, there was one time some years ago that one of these pharmaceutical companies, one of these vaccine manufacturers, you know, did something wrong and they were fined. No, this is a pattern of behavior, an ongoing pattern of behavior. They show no regard for human life, for integrity, for honesty, for truth. They only show an unbridled greed that they are willing to bribe and lie and cheat to get their profits in. I'm not speculating. This is a fact. And now I'm suddenly supposed to, with a warp speed vaccine that is gene therapy, that has not gone anything close to the safety standards that are required, that gets approved under emergency use authorization, not full FDA approval, and you might say, oh, well, one of the Pfizer vaccines ended up getting full FDA approval. It's not the one that they're circulating and injecting to people's arms right now. Separate story. We'll go down that rabbit hole. But the bottom line is that I'm supposed to now, in those circumstances, trust the integrity of these companies, which have shown time and again that they have no integrity. And I'm supposed to say, yeah, inject that into me and inject that into my children. And they're trying to take away my right to say no based on this. So why do you think the vaccines are safe? Oh, because they reported it in the studies that these pharmaceutical companies did with an extraordinary conflict of interest, because if they get the studies and the numbers look right in the studies, then they stand to make countless billions of dollars with no liability. We can't stand for it. We have to resist.
All right, so there you go, friends. That was Dr. Patrick Gentempo, and done for the day with that. I want to thank you for joining me here at Awaken America, Awaken to Empowerment Radio. Hope to catch you back here next time for our next fabulous show, and we will be free. Peace, love, freedom, peace, love, and empowerment, and, of course, peace of mind. Carol Ann Parisi saying goodbye. Download this show. Go support Dr. Patrick Gentempo. Bye.